comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right.
So, hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann. I'm the voice of Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM. And you're also listening to it on Pacifica all over the United States. This is a national broadcast. We're very appreciative that this is going to be a two-hour special on the past, present, and future of the civil rights movement. The first hour is going to be a tribute to the true giant of the civil rights movement. It's hard to say the late Julian Bond, who just died so recently. In the first hour, we're going to be joined by Judy Richardson, a tremendous filmmaker, SNCC veteran, and we'll talk about her. Clay Carson, who is the director of the King Center and the King Papers at Stanford, and the author of just one of my absolute favorite books, In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s. So they're going to be with us in a couple of minutes. So here's the sort of, I'm going to give you the whole rundown. We're going to start with Mississippi Goddamn with Nina Simone. We're then going to move to Judy and Clay. Then we're going to talk about a 30-minute interview conversation that I did with Julian Bond a little more than a year ago at the 50th anniversary of Mississippi Summer in Jackson, Mississippi. Then we're going to go back to Judy and Clay and finish up the hour. We're going to end with My Way with Nina Simone. Then at 5 o'clock, we're going to continue this two-hour national special on Pacifica. We're going to be talking with Indisha Jakali, who's an organizer in New Orleans and doing some terrific work around the right of return. We're going to hopefully listen to the Meters, Hey Pacaway, also from the backbeat of New Orleans. We'll finish up with Indisha, and then we're going to have the full version of My Way by Nina Simone as the final tribute to both Julian Bond and the 1,836 people who died in Hurricane Katrina. So my job is to keep my head on straight for 2 hours and to grasp the enormity of the conversation and the beauty of the guests. So why don't we start with our friend, and also if you've haven't seen the Liz Arbus film on Netflix about Nina Simone, it is just mind-blowing. So you understand why Nina Simone is the patron saint of Voices from the Frontlines, and she's going to be carrying us throughout this show. So Nina, why don't we start with Mississippi Goddamn.
Alabama's got to be so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn.
So, Judy Richardson, Claiborne Carson, are you with us now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so good to have you here. We're here to celebrate and to interpret the amazing life of our, especially your friend, Julian Bond. And then we're going to be playing an interview that I had with Julian at Freedom Summer, 50th anniversary. Judy, start with yourself, your law, amazing biography, your documentary filmmaker, civil rights activist. You're on the SNCC staff from 1963 to 66. In Maryland, Mississippi, during the Freedom Summer, in Georgia and Alabama, you ran the office for Julian's successful first campaign for the Georgia legislature, which you're going to hear him talk about with some irony in the conversation. Co-founded Drummond Spear Bookstore in D.C., which could be a whole other conversation, and then which was then the country's largest African-American bookstore, director of information for the United Church of Christ, and many other things. Judy, great to have you on the show.
Thank you. And I would just mention Eyes on the Prize. That was the 14-hour series that I worked on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the book of women in SNCC was
Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC, University of Illinois Press. Thank
all right.
You very much.
No, got to make sure that was done too. How do we, for especially a whole new generation, how do we grasp Julian Bond?
Well, first of all, I think you need to, in order to understand Julian, you really do need to understand him in the context of SNCC. I mean, I think the reason that all of us remained so close was that, you know, how young people, when, say you were in a dorm room with somebody for 4 years in college or whatever, and you get close to them and they may, you know, remain friends with you throughout your life. But with us, we were that age. We were 17, 18, 19 years old. Julian said he was old at 20. And at the same time, the bonds, we used to call it a band of brothers and then sisters and a circle of trust, because that bond was so strong because they were trying to kill us. You know, I mean, what we're trying to do was get economic equity, get voting rights without getting the people with whom we organized killed, and without getting ourselves killed. And so those bonds became really, really tight. And, you know, we may have had differences, but nothing broke through those bonds. They just remained with us through the rest of our lives. And so Julian was our communications director. And so when I first see him, I'm just coming off Swarthmore College's campus. I think I'm just coming to visit the national office of SNCC in Atlanta. And I see, you know, this amazing national office. And Julian is SNCC's communications director, having come off Morehouse College's campus, being one of the leaders of the Atlanta student movement at that point. And he's now, you know, I mean, my memory of him is typing with two fingers almost as fast as I could type with all of mine, and I type 90 words a minute. And he did those two fingers, and he had always had this little cigarette hanging out of his mouth. The ash is dripping down on the perpetually dirty floor of the national office, and running out, you know, press releases, contacting the press, working with Dottie Zellner, Mary King, but he was the communications director. And he, you know, and then the research department headed by Jack Minnis, which was getting out stats, because we always believed that whatever you put in communications, in the press releases and whatever, it had to be based on fact. And so Jack Minnis was head of the research department, and, you know, he could get research from a stone. And this is before Internet, before Wikipedia, before any of that stuff. And so he's feeding information. We're getting reports from the various field offices in Mississippi and Southwest Georgia and Alabama, Arkansas, and we're getting these reports daily to make sure that everybody was still alive, basically, and to find out what churches had been bombed, what schools had been mounted. And we're doing all of that through an 800 line and then compiling all of those each day. And then there were the Friends of SNCC offices all over the country, at University of Chicago and NYU, in terms of the campus Friends of SNCC, and then the regular adult ones all over the country. So we had a coordinator for all of that. We had specifically Bobby Yancey, who later becomes the number two person at the Schomburg under Howard Dodson for all those years. She becomes the head of organizing around what is now called the HBCUs, and organizing on Tuskegee and Fisk and all of those. So all of that is the hub that exists in the national office, making sure that we could facilitate the work of all of these folks in the field. And Julian was the communications director, getting the information out to the rest of the world about what we were doing in SNCC.
Well, it's funny because when you read about the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and the thing that I was always struck by is people said I'd rather be a third clarinetist than there, because it was just the greatest orchestra in the world to be with, and the people who were the third clarinetist could be the head of a band anywhere else. And I think the all-star team that SNCC put together, all the names you sang, plus 50 others, it's really amazing to be in such a group of giants, and including yourself, Judy, and I really mean that. Clay Carson, great to hear you. I've read in Struggle 20 times. I was reading it last night again. So one of the things, Clay Carson, with your long history of writing the book of In Struggle, which you said you wanted to do in some way as a gift to that historical moment, but you've stayed in the relationships with many of the key people through your own work. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Julian Bond.
Well, first of all, I would say hello to Judy.
Hello, Clay.
This is really great to talk about Julian in this context, and of course Judy knows so much more because she was there during much of the 60s. For me, I have an eternal gratefulness to Julian Bond, because In Struggle could not have been written without Julian. He was kind of the person many people expected to write the history. In fact, at some point he would say, I'm going to sit down and write the history of SNCC. But he was so busy and so doing so many things that it never got done. But what he did is leave behind all the materials that were necessary. In fact, he was the one who went around the staff, and Judy, you probably knew this, that and asking all of them to write down their biographical information. And that was crucial in terms of writing the history, of so that I could focus attention not just on the people who got their names in the newspaper, but on so many people who contributed in many ways. So Julian played the central role in taking a grassroots movement and turning it into something that could be part of the historical record, because so many times grassroots movements just don't get noticed. And another thing that brings me together with Judy is that we both worked on Eyes on the Prize, and one of the wonderful things that happened in that experience is that from the very beginning of the conception of Eyes on the Prize, we decided it wasn't going to be a story from the top down, but from the bottom up. And that there would be, King is going to get his due in terms of his contribution to the movement. But if you look at the Eyes on the Prize series, you see how much the focus is on many people whose names are just not familiar. And they get to be part of this great story of this wonderful freedom movement. And the work of the communications office of SNCC was essential, because otherwise these grassroots movements in so many communities would have never gotten national attention, never got any kind of outside, the outside help that they needed to succeed. So I see myself as simply the beneficiary of the work that Judy and Julian and so many other people. And one of the things about Julian, I guess, we can certainly bring this up, but beyond anything else, a movement that produced some people who were difficult, sometimes hard to get along with, angry about injustice to the point where they were angry to people around them. Julian was somehow managed to keep his cool. He was always the person who was the gentleman, someone who was concerned about being able to communicate on a rational level with people, trying to explain things patiently. Throughout his career, and he was one of the people who kept alive the ideas and communicated them to so many people in so many different contexts and in so many different roles. And when you look at how many people came into the movement, formed their role, but then burned out, he was a long distance runner. From the age he got first involved, maybe Judy knows sometimes when he stopped and just kind of didn't do very much for a few years, but I don't remember those times. I mean, he was always there. He was always contributing in many different ways. And without that sense of bitterness or self-promotion or anything else, I mean, he was truly a long-distance runner.
Yeah, I was almost going to call the interview, a conversation with a charming warrior. In the conversation which you're about to listen to, I mean, you'll see the combination of his just very smooth delivery, and just listen to the number of quips and sharp ideas, though, that there's quite an edge to the conversation. Judy and Clay, I hope that you can stay into the next hour, because there's so much I want to hear from you. We also have Indisha Jakali from New Orleans coming in the second hour, and I hope we can have the three of you at least into the second hour. But right now we're going to listen to almost a 30-minute conversation with me and Julian, and I'd like you to hear it. I guess you have no choice. But also then, I'm sure it'll generate lots of things that you have to say. So if that's okay, in June of 2014, myself, Eric Mann, along with Julian Lamb, Catherine Murphy, William Sabourin, we went down to Mississippi with the support of KPFK Pacifica to do a series of conversations, more than interviews, with veterans of the 50-year veterans of the 1964 Freedom Summer. And while there's a lot to say, I think we'll just let Julian Bond tell his own story. So with that, why don't we take it away?
Well, hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. We're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Every single conversation I've had has changed my views of things, have influenced me in the present. There's very little nostalgia here. There are people who are continuing to do work, continue to think, and trying to talk about, obviously, a pivotal experience for an entire generation. But most of the people here on the 50th anniversary are in the 50th anniversary of their organizing. So in that context, we're really happy to have Julian Bond with us, who's been a very important figure in the civil rights, black liberation, progressive movement. He was obviously one of the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which we'll talk about. He was elected to the Georgia State Legislature and denied admission, and that became a very important coastal lever. And you might not think that people of those politics would run for office. And then he's moved through many, many different incarnations, and I believe you were chairman of the board of the NAACP. And on the 50th anniversary of SNCC, I think you gave a really terrific speech.
Thank you. Worked hard on that.
It was a very thoughtful effort at the struggle of black people and where are they now. So in that context, Julian Bond, really nice to be with you.
Well, good to be here. Thank you for this.
What was the pivotal moment in your life when you went from believing in things to thinking you had a real obligation to act?
Well, it must have been in 1960 when a student approached me in a cafe in Atlanta and held up a newspaper to me and said, "Have you seen this?" I thought he was talking about, "Do you read the paper?" But he was talking about an article about the Greensboro sit-in and prompted me to join him in repeating that here in Atlanta. And that's when I took my first big step.
So that was quick.
Yeah.
You saw a picture and you organized a sit-in.
Right, exactly.
How were you treated?
Pretty well. Atlanta was a relatively moderate place in race relations. If you got outside the city, you're in real trouble. But
right.
Within the city limits, it was okay. So the police acted as you want policemen to. Nothing really harmful. But it was a good introduction to activism for me.
Now, I make a distinction between activism and organizing, because to me, activism is an act of participation. Organization becomes a long-term commitment and actually building an institution. When did you think you made the transition from seeing yourself as an activist to someone who wanted to build an institution like SNCC?
Shortly after the incident I just told you about, and it's interesting because I got involved in the sit-in demonstrations believing that would be a relatively short-lived act process.
Right, right.
But I joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, believing that would be relatively short-lived, but longer than the sit-ins.
Right.
And didn't think it would last forever for the rest of my life, and of course it didn't. But thought that would be a little longer lasting. Then I joined the NAACP, which was already ancient at that time, and is over 109 years old now. So that was another example of longevity with an organization. And I'm not really associated with any organization right now, but still I'm doing many of the things I was doing in those other organizations.
Well, let's go back to relationships with some pivotal figures, okay? Ella Baker.
Ella Baker, I was thinking about her today. We saw a picture of her after the scream when we were talking about those who passed away. Ella Baker lived in an apartment building in Atlanta called the Walla Haji. It was named after the people who built it, whose names were Wallace and Hodges, hence Walla Haji. And she had a very small apartment there. And I remember visiting her in her apartment and her taking out a quart of bourbon, which was welcome to me at the time. I was drinking bourbon at the time. And she was just a remarkable person. And peculiarly, or maybe not peculiarly, I could never call her Ella. Many of the women who worked for SNCC called her Ella. But I called her Miss Baker. She was always Miss Baker to me, and she always will be Miss Baker to me. And she was such an expert at saying to you, not do this, but have you thought of doing that? And there's a great difference between those two things, and she was just a master at it.
Well, even though it's an archetypical story, it is very important that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee came together as just a coordinating committee at first, of that there were a lot of sit-ins,
right.
And wouldn't it be good if we sort of all got together and had a mutual strategy, right?
Because she understood, Ella Baker understood, that we might not have the experience, might not have the thought to do this in an organized way. Or we might have, but if we didn't, wouldn't it be better if we develop ourselves, and can't you develop it yourselves? She never said do this or do that. She always said, don't you think you might do this?
And the story is that she encouraged Dr. King to not make this an adjunct of SCLC.
Right, and the students, she also encouraged young people not to become an adjunct of SCLC or the NAACP,
right.
Or the Corps
for Race
Equality, or any of these organizations. Why don't you make one of your own? And we made one of our own.
Amazing contribution to history, right?
Yeah.
James Forman.
I can't remember when I met Forman for the very first time, but I met him when he was fresh from Monroe, North Carolina, where he'd been to talk to Robert Williams, the NAACP president,
yeah.
Returned Klan fire with black fire. And he was fresh from that and came to Atlanta to meet people in this new phenomenon called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And very quickly we understood that in part because of his age, he was older than we were, and part because of his wisdom, that he'd make a great director of this organization, and we prevailed on him to take it, and bam, there he was.
He came out of the service?
Yes, he came out of the service, and I think his service period was an example of building for him, learning new things for him in ways we did not have. Almost none of us had been in the service, and almost none of us went in the service. I never did, but I thought this was some training for him that he had that advanced him above the level where we were.
I've read some old documents. He did a lot of writing about the theory of organizations and how could SNCC function, and gave a lot of attention to the actual building of an organization. Malcolm X.
I never met Malcolm X for longer than a period of, hello, how are you doing, good to see you. So I can't say I knew him in any real sense of the word, but I was around him on a couple of occasions and saw him operate. And watched him operate and grew to understand that here's a man who had a real idea of how to go about things, how to plan, how to go from here to there in a way that I think younger people didn't quite know. So he was just such a remarkable man. It was a thrill to be around him. And one of the great things I remember about him is him saying to a crowd, not to me, but to a crowd, he said, man, those people in the Southern Movement made me look funny. He said, they're really onto something. So, you know, you appreciate that kind of pat on the back, like another one we got from President Kennedy. You get this on the White House tapes. He's talking to his advisors during the Birmingham campaign, complaining about something that happened in Birmingham the night before, and he says, those SNCC people are sons of bitches. I love that.
That's right. That's one of the best compliments. Fannie Lou Hamer.
I did know Ms. Hamer more than I knew Malcolm X. She was just such a pleasant person, such an outgoing person, who didn't have much formal education, but was so outreaching, the sort of person you felt you could be with, you could be close to, you could learn from her, you could be a part of her. She was just remarkable in that way. She was open to you. That was her genius, I think.
Then another one of her geniuses was laying out very pithy formulations that you would remember and act on.
Yes, indeed.
You know, like she came to the Newark Community Union Project, and we had a second floor office, and she walked in and she said, if I come back next year and you don't have a storefront, you'll never see me again. And we got a storefront. I mean, she said, well, how are you expecting people to climb stairs? And we hadn't thought of it, you know.
Yeah,
she wasn't the only person. Then she came in and gave a three-hour presentation about her negotiations with Walter Reuther, mm-hmm. Bayard Rustin, even King, mm-hmm. Humphrey. And, of course, the line was, they literally, Bayard Rustin pointed to Humphrey and said, Miss Hamer, if you take the compromise, Hubert Humphrey could be vice president of the United States. And she said, with all due respect, I didn't come up all the way from Mississippi to make you vice president of the United States. I thought you wanted to be vice president of the United States to seat the people from Mississippi.
Yeah.
And then she turned to us and said, so there's two lessons here. One, compromise is not a bad word, but one party wins the compromise and one party loses. And if they offered us a winning compromise, I would have taken it. Number two, never sign on to anything that you cannot take to your base in good conscience, because you are representing people. And if you come back and say, I didn't get it, they don't mind. But if you said, I gave it away, you'll be in big, big trouble.
Exactly so.
And that's what I teach. It's totally changed my understanding of organizing. And I've been in situations, in negotiations, where I realized, no, we're going to bring it back to the group, and if the group doesn't want it, we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Did you play an active role in the MFTP?
No, not really, because of James Foreman. This is a funny story. We had, I don't know if the order was this hurt, but SNCC took a trip to Africa, and I went. And the trip to Guinea. And some people, John Lewis and Don Harris, went further than other African states. But I was with the group that only went to Guinea and then went to Paris and then came back to the States. That was, I think, just before the convention in Atlantic City. And so Foreman told me I couldn't go because I had gone to Africa. And a little while later, I realized that he went to Africa. So why couldn't I go too?
No, that sounds like James Foreman too. Let's talk about your candidacy for the legislature of Georgia. I think one of the things that's fascinating about that is people didn't understand that we had a pretty multifaceted understanding of what we were doing. We were not just protesters. We had a strategy. And obviously, they were seen as an opportunity to get you elected. I think most of our listeners and viewers don't even know this story. So how did this happen?
This came about because a federal court had reapportioned the Georgia legislature. Georgia had a most malapportioned legislature of all the states in the United States. And it meant that rural areas had enormous power. Urban areas, where the population was, had relatively little power. And so a court order reapportioned the legislature, and I found myself living in the middle of one of these new districts of equal size with other districts, and it meant that black people would be elected to the House of Representatives in Georgia for the first time since Reconstruction, as long ago as that. So I ran for one of these districts, and I won. A friend of mine, Ben Brown, who sadly has died, ran in the adjacent district. We were very close, and he won his, and I won mine, and we were all set to take our seats. We knew that we would meet hostility by white legislators who didn't want black people in the legislature, but we didn't expect any trouble about this, just some reaction. But then, just before we were to take our seats, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee issued an anti-war statement, which if I told you about it today, you'd say, oh, people say that all the time now.
Right.
But then it sounded radical and extreme, and it caused a great deal of hoorah in the general population, and the legislators were just outraged that we would dare to have opinions about foreign policies, and the opinions would be contrary to theirs. So as the date for my taking my seat arrived, the opposition began to bubble and rise up. And when the day for me to take my seat came, legislators-to-be decided to put me out of the legislature. They declared my seat vacant and called for a new election. And I ran for in that election, and I won that election, and they called me out of the legislature again. I ran again for a third time, and in the interim, I filed a lawsuit, and it was heard by a three-judge federal court, and the two judges appointed by President Kennedy voted against me, and the judge appointed by President Nixon voted for me.
Wow.
Because this was just at the time when the Republican Party was in the middle of some transition, and the Democratic Party was in the middle of some transition, too. At any rate, I appealed the decision to the Supreme Court. And I had never been to the Supreme Court, so I went up to hear my case being argued. And I found myself sitting in the front row of the spectator seats next to Victor Rabinowitz, who was my lawyer.
Oh, really?
His law partner was Leonard Boudin.
Oh.
He was arguing the case for me. And so I'm sitting next to Victor Rabinowitz and listening to the Attorney General of Georgia argue that they had a right to throw me out, that I had said things that were contrary to American public opinion and therefore ought to be thrown out of the legislature. And something remarkable happened. I'd never been to the Supreme Court before, and I didn't understand that the justices would interfere with lawyers. And Justice Byron White, who was well known as Wizard White because he was the only Supreme Court justice who played for the NFL.
That's right.
And he said to the Attorney General, to his argument, he said, is that all you have? He said, that's all you have. You come all this way, and that's all you have. So I hunched Victor Rabinowitz. I said, we're winning now, aren't we? He said, yes, you are. And we won 9-0. 9-0.
Well, it's very important to know that that's a beautiful story. And it's also important that Victor Rabinowitz is a story unto himself.
Yes,
Leonard
is.
Boudin, you had gold. You had two of the greatest civil rights lawyers, most brilliant So when you're just dropping the name,
ACLU wouldn't support me, wouldn't defend me because I had them. this
well,
might be the people helping my civil liberties, but I didn't have the civil liberties to choose a lawyer of my own choosing.
Or lawyers that were closer to the Communist Party.
Yes, right.
Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoy, the same, were the two greatest lawyers I knew at the time, but you were very fortunate to have Victor Rabinowitz and Leonard Boudin, who were only two of the truly greatest civil rights lawyers in the United States at the time.
Oh, yeah, they're just fabulous. I couldn't have chosen anybody as good as they were.
And I want to go back a step about what, when you ran in the district, because you won three times, you know, as they always say, let's keep running the election until we get it right.
Yeah.
Right? So what did you talk to the people about in this predominantly black district?
Well, first I laid out a platform, and then I went around to them asking them how they liked my platform and what I could change in my platform, do better, do worse,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And I can't remember it all. It's been so long ago. But one thing was to increase the minimum wage in Georgia to, I think, $1.50, which is nothing.
Right.
Absolutely nothing. But anyway, it was a fairly well thought out and vetted campaign platform, vetted with my constituents. I asked them, well, what do you think about this? Is this okay? Is this a good idea?
Right.
Do you like that? Or so on. And they were just astounded because they had never had somebody ask them these questions before. They had never elected a legislator from this district. It never happened before, a district this small. And whomever they had had before in the larger district that preceded my district, they never had anybody ask them what they wanted. So I think it was an innovation for them as it was for me. So that's the way I campaigned.
Well, at the time, we were very moved by the concept of participatory democracy, mm-hmm. right? And I was organizing in Newark and SNCC. I think we had a vision of a revolutionary democracy in which the actual people at the grassroots would be asked for once. And then the question was, could the people, after they're asked, get enough power to win? So I want to jump, in a funny way, after the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, because I'm very interested in this period of all the choices that people made after the MFDP. Obviously, Stokely moved to the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, which I thought was pretty exciting, which people don't know, to rebuild an actual base on the ground. About over a year there with John Hewlett. Other people moved in more, quote, revolutionary directions. Other people moved in more nationalist directions. Other people moved to reform the Democratic Party and say, no, it's not automatically the end of this conversation. First, what of those paths, what were you thinking at the time? And it helped me, since I think you and I are always trying to keep everybody in one, why can't we all get along policy, which is me. Like, I understand this difference, but is this really what we're going to break up over? So where were you, and then what were your efforts to try to build a broader civil rights black movement at the time?
I didn't try to build the Democratic Party in a different direction. I wish now I had. I'd done something to create a political party of some kind with some relevance to what people really needed and what they wanted. But I didn't do that. I ran every 2 years as a Democrat. I won elections one after the other for 20 years. Worked in the House, got elected to the State House, got elected to the State Senate. So that's what I did. And I didn't, I'm sorry to say, do as much as I could have done or should have done in Georgia itself. Instead, I traveled all over the country. I got invitations to speak here and there and someplace else. After the Chicago Political Democratic Party convention, I began to be inundated with invitations to go here and there and talk about things. And I generally talked about the war, had an anti-war attitude and argued against the war, and talked about race relations and what the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee could do, and what my listeners could do, what people could do themselves in their own neighborhoods, their own community. So that's why I spent almost the next, say, 20-odd years is doing that.
Well, one of the things that I think, again, in terms of, I mean, both I've lived this history, but then I just study history every day, including, of course, way, way back history. But I don't think people, again, understand the significance of a civil rights movement that took such a militant stand against the war.
Yeah, no.
And that from when SNCC came out with Hell No, We Won't Go, that had such a profound influence. I think that was the first time I consciously became anti-war. Then there was the SDS march on Washington in April of 65. There was Muhammad Ali's amazing campaign. There was King's campaign. But every one of those was met with such repression from King. People don't realize that Ali was sentenced to 5 years in prison for draft evasion. So let's talk about that, the explosive intersection of the war and the civil rights, and those who are telling us, no, no, those are two separate issues.
It's interesting that today I met a man who had put on the first moratorium, and that meant something special to me because I met my wife-to-be at the first moratorium. So, and this guy who put on the first and second moratoriums told me an interesting history of the time between the first and the second. Between the first, the idea of the moratorium was simply to say there are many, many Americans who are against the war and they want it stopped, and they'd be welcoming if this were happening. This is Nixon was president of the United States. From the first moratorium to the second moratorium, the repression just grew and grew and grew. Agnew was unleashed and began to attack the student protesters and so on in a vituperative way, the way he'd not done so before. And I didn't realize this. This guy's telling me this. And something else happened that showed the repression echoing up and just showed what the war machine would do, the horrors it would do. So I had not understood this history before. It was just interesting to have him tell it to me. Made me understand what was happening around me in a way I had not before.
Well, in Bearing the Cross by David Garrow, there's just the whole section of what happened after the Vincent Harding, Martin Luther King speech at the Riverside.
Right.
It was, I believe, 1967. The extent of the attacks on King after he took the war position. Dramatic loss of money, dramatic loss of influence, and he was shocked.
Yeah.
But he sort of knew it was coming. So I just want to say that I don't think a lot of white people understand that so much of the anti-war movement was black.
Yeah.
And so much of the anti-war energy came out of what was perceived as the civil rights movement. What brought you to the NAACP?
Well, I had, SNCC had disappeared.
Right.
We think destroyed by the federal government. And there seemed to be no alternative to it. And I looked at the NAACP because in Atlanta, at the time, the NAACP was a vibrant, strong organization, a neighborhood-based organization, active in this, that, and the other things, on the march all the time. And it seemed to be the last man standing. And I said, I want to be a part of that. So I joined the NAACP, but I'd not done much with the NAACP as a member, but only active in the sense that I paid my dues. I became engaged in it. I got elected chairman of the local NAACP. Then I got elected to the board of directors of the NAACP. I had a fight with the incumbent board chairman. He managed to throw me out of the NAACP. I fought back.
Wait a minute, do you have a problem of getting thrown out of things?
Yes. Anyway, he threw me out of the NAACP.
Right.
Where was it? Oh, so anyway, so then I got elected chairman of the board, and I served as chairman of the board for 11 years.
One of the things that, to me, is very interesting, again, about reading history is that in our meaning 64 to 68 experience, I think it's fair to say that SNCC and CORE, where I came from, we saw the NAACP as a big obstacle.
I saw it as a big obstacle, too, when
right.
I was young.
Right.
But I grew to understand it's sturdy, it's here. It's, if you go over here, it's really great. If you go over there, it's not so great. This one is wonderful, this one is not so.
Well, the thing I understood the most, because I think Roy Wilkins was a very destructive force in history, this is just my own opinion, but when I read I've Got the Light of Freedom by Charles Payne,
right.
I was shocked to understand that the NAACP had been the bulwark of the most deep South repressive areas, Amsey Moore, and people
yes,
had been
right.
building these NAACP chapters from the 30s and 40s had been facing lynching, and they had been sometimes armed. I mean, I changed my opinion of this, what I'm saying is
yes.
I said, you know,
me too.
I said, you know, Eric, you had this little four-year window, but you didn't understand this history, right? Do you think that's fair?
Oh, absolutely.
One question I wanted to ask you is that one of the common themes of the conference this weekend was, yes, we've elected more black Democrats, but has there really been an improvement in the conditions of black people through that? And let's at least look at the Obama administration as one of the greatest victories in some ways. And I certainly think the election of Barack Obama was a historic event beyond anything that could have been comprehended. But how do you perceive now 7 years into the Obama administration, what's that model indicate for you?
Well, it indicates to me that you've got to do more than elect the president. You've got to elect Congress people. And the movement I'm associated with, the movements I'm associated with, learned how to do the one, but never learned how to do the other. And really messed up when it came to the off-season elections. You know, they fell victim of the tales that are told us that in the off-season elections, the president's party always loses. Well, sure he does, but why does he have to? Why does that have to be so? Why can't we do better? Why can't this marvelous machine that elected Barack Obama, why can't it elect one or two people or 50 or 60 people to Congress of the United States? It's something I think we need to learn how to do, and we haven't learned how to do it yet. But if we don't do it, I mean, we're doomed to just elect a lot of great presidents, and that's it.
Well, my view is that even within the first year, I think he took the wind out of the sails of a lot of his people. And I think that with the shocking reaching out across the aisle, the horrible attacks on him that we all wanted to fight, it was like, come on, if you take them on, we'll take them on, and letting the Tea Party, the grotesque racism against him as a president of the United States, and the bailing out of Wall Street, not having a social program for the poor. Within a year, I was talking to a lot of people, and they went, okay, I'm glad he's elected, but I don't see him as our friend. See, I don't believe that an appeal to the president of the United States is going to help us. But by the time in the sixth year, it's very hard to tell people you got to elect congressmen when the election of a black president should have been a watershed, even if it wasn't completely.
I think it was a watershed. I agree with what you're saying, and I agree with your analysis, but I think it was a watershed. And I think the second election was more powerful than the first, because the second election proved that the first was not a fluke.
That's right.
It was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. I cried for that one. It was just great.
Oh, I did too. I mean,
I had plenty of disappointments. I'm sure I'm going to have some more, but I'm so happy he's there.
Well, I'm in a very ambivalent relationship because my family, we were so excited about the first Obama. The second one was more of my strategic thinking coming, all right, I am not that excited, but we are not going to let Mitt Romney get elected. We are not going to get the first black president defeated. And I went back with enthusiasm again, you know, with a little different understanding.
We're bound to be this way every election. This is what happened to us every election. Please say no.
Well, last thoughts. There must be a lot going through your head on the 50th anniversary. So many people you've seen, reconstructing your own life. So share with me just a couple of things that's going on in your mind.
You opened this with saying that it's not just nostalgia.
Right.
But a lot of it is nostalgia for me. To see old friends, to see old buddies, to see these people with whom I went through the most important years of my life just means so much to me. I'm so happy to be here. I don't want it to end. I know we just have, as of today, two more days. A day, just another one more day. I don't count Sunday. But I'm going to miss it. And I know that some of these people I'll never see again.
That's right.
As I don't see here some of the people I saw when we did the 30th anniversary and as we're doing this one. So I feel sad about that. But I also see the young people who are here and think this is our future, and they are being educated in what they need to be doing. And many of the older people here, people my age and older, are continuing doing what they were doing. It's not like they're just sitting down saying, here, you take over. It's standing up and saying, let's do this together. So I'm optimistic about this. I've been an optimist all my life, in spite of having common sense at the same time. But I believe, you know, we can do it. Whatever needs to be done, we can do it.
I completely agree with you, and I want to take back my nostalgia word because I thought it was pejorative in ways I didn't mean.
Yeah.
Because I think you're absolutely right that we're going back to a period that a new generation so far has not been blessed enough to go through,
right,
and had a level of relationships to each other, mm-hmm, a level of personal risk, a level of personal transformation in which your own beliefs were challenged daily, mm-hmm, and relationships that were built under conditions that people couldn't imagine. So I definitely want to take back that, because I think the reconnection with our own history is a very critical part of it, and thanks for that reorientation.
Okay, good.
And the last thing is, I think all organizers are optimists.
Yes, I think you have to be.
You have to be. I mean, I go to bed upset. The next morning, I got a new idea.
Sure.
Whatever the problem was when I went to bed, I spent the night, okay, have we tried this?
Yeah.
You know, and I just think that's why we're going to win.
Indeed, you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you so much, Julian Bonnet.
Wow, well, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines on Pacifica. Listening to it, I was obviously very moving when he said that we may not see some of the people. It just never dawned on me that one of the people we may not see again would be Julian himself. I'm back with Judy Richardson and Clay Carson. I'm sure who have so much more to say. Thank you so much for staying through the whole conversation. Clay, why don't you start with just anything that the conversation think about?
One thing that strikes me in listening to Julian is just how articulate he is in that interview. And, of course, I think you brought up some of the real strong points, and I compliment you on the interview. But you see how able he is to explain things. He was the great communicator of the movement. I mean, when we think of Martin Luther King, that's one of his, obviously one of his skills. But in a different way, now Martin Luther King was a preacher. Julian Bond was a movement intellectual. He was able to explain where we've been, where we're going, and in a way that just was able to reach so many people in different walks of life. And it's just a pleasure to listen to him.
Judy?
Oh, I think she might have had to.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, well, one thing, Clay, is that, to stay on that, is that I was so struck by, every sentence was perfectly formed, from beginning to end. Every concept was the way he just, you'd ask him a question and it was almost like his mind can just construct sentence, then paragraph, then page, with not an not a pause, just, and obviously some of those things he hadn't quite thought of, but the minute you ask him, he knew what he wanted to say. I'm very moved by the dynamic. I was so moved by the relationship that the two of us had in the conversation, and started the whole thing by saying, well, this is not just about nostalgia. What I meant by that, as I was sort of in my mind speaking to a young generation that at times I think is so dismissive of us, but he just waited, didn't say a word, right? Waited for the whole conversation, and then he ends by saying, and I just want to say I disagree with what you said about nostalgia, like, just as a good intellectual, just for the record, I don't see it that way. And, of course, he was right. So, such a rich, rich history. Clay Carson, you think about this all the time. You are a historian. Just a few last thoughts on what you think his legacy is and what you think people that want to know more about him, how could they go about doing so?
Well, let's put him in a context. And the context I would say is we need to think in broader terms about what happened in the 60s, because otherwise we're not going to understand the connection to what's going on right now. What, to me, the most important thing happening in the world at that time was the fact that for the first time in history, the majority of humanity gained citizenship rights. So at the same time we were gaining civil rights reform in the United States, 50 other countries in the 2 decades after World War II were gaining their independence. And those two things were connected in a really vital way, and that helps explain why the Vietnam War was very important, because one of those places that was gaining their independence was Vietnam. And so we were coming out of a struggle for citizenship rights in the United States, and rather than seeing Vietnam as an enemy, basically, our argument in terms of the war was that we were on the wrong side and that we should have been supporting Vietnam instead of taking the place of the French in keeping them a colonized nation. So I think that when we look at this in global terms, we see Julian Bond and Stokely Carmichael and Bob Moses and Ella Baker, all of them were part of what I would consider history's greatest freedom struggle. And it achieved something that was fundamentally important, because without your basic rights, it's hard to imagine going on to achieve something more than that. But the people like Julian, who came out of that struggle, also understood, as great as that achievement was, there was something more. King's last book was, where do we go from here? And people forget the here was, we've already got the Voting Rights Act. We've already got the Civil Rights Act. And he's still asking, but where do we go from here? And Julian is asking that question. And, everybody is coming up with different answers. Julian's answer might have been different from Stokely Carmichael's answer. different from Martin Luther King's answer. But the point is, they understood that the struggle was not over. And part of what they were trying to say was, we need to build upon that achievement. And that's the legacy that we leave to the current generation, so that they don't see themselves as starting it all over.
I mean, that's great. Judy.
Oh, hi, Judy.
Hi. Yeah, I got cut off, so I'm back on. One of the things, just building on what Clay was talking about, is that, you know, I mean, if we remember also that one of Julian's last protests was against the Keystone Pipeline. You know, the thing that was really important, and Clay mentioned it earlier before that wonderful interview. I wish I'd heard more from Julian, because he really, you know, you just get a real sense of where he was in 2010. But one of the really important things that Clay mentioned is that Julian always had time to talk to people who were studying the movement. He never was impatient with them. So when he's talking to Clay, he's also talking to, I mean, most recently he emailed me to say, you know, you always get the interviews from people who are doing their dissertations and they want to talk to you about whatever. And so at a certain point you get tired of that. Julian never got tired. And the other part was...
Judy, I'm going to have to hold you just a second. Okay. We need to go on break. And we're on Pacifica nationally. We're at KPFK in Los Angeles. We're holding this, but this is a national conversation with Judy Richardson, Claiborne Carson. We're going to take a break, and I hope you both can keep that conversation going at least for a few minutes into the next hour. And then we're going to have another wonderful guest, Andisha Jakhani, who's going to talk about the struggle in New Orleans. So we're going to take a short break, and I hope you could hold that thought, and we'll keep going.
The end is near, and so I got to face the final curtain.
And this is Alan Minsky live in KPFK Studios, and you're listening to a special two-hour national broadcast of Voices from the Frontlines, both about the life and legacy of Julian Bond and the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Background Briefing with Ian Masters will be back at 5 p.m. tomorrow. But stay tuned for the second half of a special national broadcast with KPFK's Eric Mann, host of Voices from the Frontlines.
Yes, regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had.